The following Noble Path talk is part of an informal series offered to Sangha members for those who've been practicing at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Each Sangha member shares their experience of how they came to find the Dharma and how their practice has been developing. We hope you enjoy the diversity of voices and experiences. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. If you come here fairly often, you've probably heard me giving announcements or instructions for Kinhin, or I don't know, lots of different little things. I gave a Noble Path talk, which went into kind of what Jiryu just said I was going to talk about, but I talked about it already a few years ago when we were just coming out of COVID and we were reopening the temple. I wanted to take it up a little bit, take something else up a little bit more deeply today. When Hojin came up with the idea that we should do these lay-led talks at the temple, I was really enthusiastic. I thought, what a great idea. But I have this enthusiasm problem of feeling really enthusiastic about a lot of things. And then when you're actually up here, it does error. I'm like, oh, whose idea was this? Why did I say, yeah, sign me up? It's just that they make it seem really easy. And you're like, I can do that. Haven't you felt that way before when someone's giving a talk up here and you're like, yeah, I've got some wisdom to share. I can do that. And then when you come up, you're like, I have nothing to say. I have nothing. So I'm really just hoping to be of benefit. So take up whatever resonates with you and feels true. And hopefully that will lead a little, be a light for you in some ways. When I first came to the temple, which was, I think about 17 or 18 years ago, was for a poetry retreat. And I was very certain that meditation was not for me. I'd been dabbling in it, going to yoga places where meditation was part of it. And I was just like, no, that's not for me. That's for people who are calmer or people who have got their stuff together more. And then when I came to the temple, there was something going on about the place that just said, maybe. But even though as I said maybe, at the same time, I also said, I looked up to God, and I was like, please, God, don't let it be meditation. Please, anything but meditation. So I didn't come back for months because I really did not want this to be part of my life. And when I did come, I was really put off by the robes and by the rakusus and by a lot of things. I felt very uncomfortable until I heard Shugen Roshi speak, who was living here at the time, and then everything dropped away, and I said, "Oh, okay, maybe I can come back," and come back I did. So I wanted to speak about this coming back, this constancy, which is an odd word, right? Constancy, it even feels weird when you say it. It's an old-fashioned kind of word, and it's about as sexy or as interesting as saying prudence or like patience, right? They sound like something a grandmother would tell you to have or to give you a lecture about, maybe. Sounds like something sensible for breakfast, like prunes or oatmeal. And I was a chocolate chip cookie for breakfast kind of gal, so I was like, what? It sounds like the opposite of rebellion or progress, right? It's much more interesting ideas, these ideas of rebellion, of moving forward, of letting go, right? They suggest like living into the unknown. But constancy, which I'm sure you know, just means to be steadfast and to be firm. And so it gives us the known, right? When we're constant, it makes us the known. So just like you, when you come here, you probably have a good sense that I will probably be here, Tenfu will likely be here. When you're waiting for the bus or the train to go to work, you want to know that it's going to be there so that you can get to work on time. If you get coffee at a coffee shop and someone knows your order because they know your face, and it feels good. We like the kind of constancy. It feels like we found a place, right? I have somebody who I buy my Long Island Remote ticket from Jamaica to Atlantic Terminal every day, and the guy behind the counter knows me. I walk through the door, and he starts punching in exactly where I'm going, and I love that. I love that he knows where I'm going to be, where I'm going. But I didn't love it for a long time. I didn't love constancy, the idea of it. I just like to say, I'm a Sagittarius, right? I need to be free. I can't commit. Don't try to hold me down. I'm a wild woman. You know, I need to just be myself. And this idea that constancy was what was required of me to be an adult really did not make me happy. But I'm going to suggest today that constancy in our practice is a portal for miracles. I'm going to suggest that constancy is a major creative force that builds community, builds sangha, and is the antidote to cynicism. It lives with patience and is good friends with mindfulness and presence, which are all great building blocks for strong Dharma practice. But it's also mind expanding. It's like when you look deeply at a flower. And sometimes you just pass by flowers, no big deal. But if you look at it, really, you'll notice the pink petals, let's say, start to turn kind of deeper pink as you get to the edge of the petal. And that when you look inside, you've got white and green in there that you didn't expect. And it's the whole of creation is happening inside of there, right? You just needed to look. You just needed some slow care. So that's maybe another better definition for constancy, a slow, persistent care. In her 1977 lyric essay, Annie Dillard, who's a writer, uses the phrase wholly the firm to refer to an essential element of the material world that touches the absolute with a capital A. For her, this was a reference to God. It's no longer a reference to God for me. But for her, it meant, and I think this is true for us as well, that the holy is with us all the time. And I think it's really meaningful that she landed on the adjective firm to describe this really immaterial element, this holy thing, which is transcendent and yet so completely present, that it's as firm as the ground on which we stand. As Buddhists, or at least I've heard Shugen say this, and I love it so much that I'm just going to say that it's a Buddhist thing, because he said it, so it must be. And so he says, we never fail to cover the ground on which we stand. And I love that. I love that reminder that we are complete, that this firmness of our own nature, we are steadfastly and completely Buddhas. I did not even begin to think that that was true until I had been consistently practicing for a long, long time. The world that we rush through and that rushes through us with words and judgments and these haphazard, half-meant, sometimes feels like daily cruelties, and also these like almost daily half-apologies that are just mumbled at us. It doesn't give us a place to consider our Buddha nature, our completeness. Most of the time, we feel inadequate, and we walk around confirming our inadequacies by comparing ourselves to others or making others feel inadequate, because for a hot second, we'll feel better. And at the same time, we're trying to get affirmation from the one or two people we've decided really matter. So this is a whirlwind. At least this is a whirlwind for me. This is a whirlwind that I find myself, or definitely found myself living in. It was an emotional roller coaster ride. I could not stand still, and I really needed to. The poet Yeats said, the center will not hold in the widening gyre, turning and turning, where will we land? So we come to this place of stillness. We come to maybe this temple. Maybe it's our seat at home. Maybe it's a seat under a tree in the park. We do this so we can come back to ourselves over and over again. When we do this by ourselves, we can make some space away from the noise. When we do this in community with others, then we are building something. We are putting some bricks and mortar around that space, and we are calling it holy. We are making it firm. We are supporting each other, and we are taking the first step to creating a Sangha. So I know that you think that what you do on your cushion is yours alone. It seems that way. And your mind may be in a thousand places, but I will hold you. We hold each other. And when I'm sitting next to you and my leg starts to itch and I don't scratch it, I don't scratch it because you are beside me. I don't scratch it for you. I don't scratch it for me. As Robin Wall Kimmerer says, all flourishing is mutual. So we practice together and we flourish together. The deep gift of presence is given to us through constancy. In Spanish, when we want to say that we are in attendance, especially if you want to say it as more than just here, maybe you want to say it if you're a part of a cause. I grew up hearing it mostly like in revolutionary or rebellious circles. We say presente. And it says, count on me. It's not just saying here. It's saying, I'm here, completely present. I'm part of this struggle. You can count on me. But there's no burden implied here. There's none of that thickness or the heaviness of obligation, right? So how does this happen? How do we keep constant and how do we stay presente and not get bored or tired or dull or make it into a habit? How do we keep it holy? We want it to have that lightheartedness, right? That spirit of life. So I saw the movie Perfect Days, directed by Wim Wenders and starring Koji Yakusho. I don't know if you saw it, but it doesn't matter. If you didn't see it yet, don't worry. It's not about spoilers because the movie just has to be like experienced. I can tell you every single thing that happens and it still wouldn't be a spoiler. So just, that's fine. And I saw it because Tenfu told me you must see this movie. So I did. I always do what Tenfu tells me to do. So Koji Yakusho plays a Tokyo public toilet cleaner named Hirayama. And just the idea of being a public toilet cleaner, like in New York City, you're like, what? A, that sounds disgusting. B, we don't have any. But he lives a simple life that seems to epitomize constancy. He gets up every morning, goes to work at the same time. What seems to wake him is this subtle sound of a street cleaner passing their broom over the sidewalk, and that's it. He wakes up, right? And he prepares himself for the day in the same exact way. He's brushing his teeth, he's trimming his mustache, washing his face, putting on his uniform. He gets a can of coffee for the machine outside. It's exactly the same. He drives to one public toilet after another and cleans it with this deep care and like love that elevates this mundane task. It feels like it's an act of reverence. And by the way, if you haven't seen the movie, the toilets are beautiful. They're like, apparently they're made by architects. These are all real life Tokyo toilets made by real life architects who go on to like design these grand buildings. So I was definitely jealous. I was just like, we need a couple of those. But it's not just cleaning the toilets that Hirayama gives his constant care to. His constancy is everywhere. It's when he first leaves his apartment in the morning and there's nothing beautiful outside that door. It looks like you're walking out of a New York City everyday side street neighborhood. But you can tell just by looking at his face with this half smile that he's really recognizing the start of the day, his place in it, and that it's good. Can imagine yourself waking up that way, right? And sometimes I do. Sometimes I wake up this way and I'm like, yeah, I'm at ease with the day. I'm at ease with myself and my place in it. And I get this little sneaky half smile. And I'm like, And my husband's like, what are you smiling about? And I'm like, nothing. Because what am I going to say, right? I'm smiling because everything feels complete. I feel complete. He's cool. He would understand that, I think. But I don't say it anyway. So Hirayami eats lunch in the same park. He takes pictures of the same tree. He eats dinner in the same restaurant. And when he falls asleep, images of the day, the pictures he's taken, what he's seen throughout the day, he just kind of lives through them again. They kind of race through his mind right before he falls asleep and before a new day dawns. These images, like these are glimpses of a life, and they reminded me of like haikus. So haikus are created when you're looking at something closely and yet quickly. There's this book called Thinking Fast and Slow. About something completely different, but haikus remind me of like looking fast and slow. And there's one I wanted to share with you by Issa, which goes, "Oh snail, climb Mount Fuji, but slowly, slowly." Isn't that great? Right? It's like a prescription for living. Oh snail, climb Mount Fuji, but slowly, slowly. So even though Hirayama's life seems narrow with repeated customs or almost completely unvarying, when things happen that require him to open up and bend, he's able to do that. So that the life we see, which can be limited and seem boring, doesn't really feel that way because it's filled with presence. There's a vibrant joy for life which comes through in Hirayami's every action. So that when the world needed him to expand, when he needed to accommodate something new, he was able to do that. There's an elasticity and constancy when it's alive. The poet Jane Kenyon reminds us of the blessings of the ordinary in her poem, Otherwise. I just took a little piece of it from the beginning, where he goes, "I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise." Knowing that things can be otherwise also helps keep us open and alive within our constancy. Years ago, when the line for Dyson was called, tradition was to jump up and run to get online. So some folks slipped and fell. And so we changed that. Which you may have noticed, we don't run the way we used to. But I used to actually dawdle or spend my entire time when I should have been in Zazen thinking about some mind-blowing question that I should ask Shugen Roshi to impress him with my deep practice. That never happened. My questions were never mind-blowing. And I think I'm still waiting to see if he is impressed by my deep practice. So instead of doing Zazen, I spent my time deliberating whether I wanted to get on the line at all, you know? And Shugen would say, don't think about it. When you hear the call for you, you know, with your north side, south side, whatever, your line, just get up and get on the line. Don't let the mind get in the way of the good sense of your body. And I heard the same teaching in the context of AA from a friend who described getting to a meeting when he didn't really want to go as having smart feet. So if left to his own deliberations, he probably would have stayed home and missed the meeting. But his feet just took him forward. And I do that on many Sundays. I don't think about it. I don't think, do I want to go to temple today? Maybe I want to sleep in. There's no deliberating back and forth. I just let my body pull me here. And when I'm here consistently, my practice deepens and lifts, but it's not really it. And my life changed, huge change. It was by coming over and over and over and letting the Dharma do its work on me that I was led to divorce my ex-husband. I only have one ex. Divorce my ex-husband. I know, I was going to make it seem like I had been married a whole bunch of times. I was like, let me see, which ex was that? Like, there's only one ex. And that was really nothing other than finding my freedom in so many ways. And then a few years later, I realized I really didn't want to be a lawyer. And I had been a lawyer for 22 years. But I realized that my vocation was to be a teacher. And I changed that. It was a pretty big deal, right? Those are just a couple of big changes. And I actually remember the breaking open that occurred when I realized I had to divorce my husband at the time. I remember feeling like these drops of water were falling on a rock, just coming and practicing. Each one was a drop and a drop and a drop. And then at one point, it broke. It just broke. And I broke really into myself. Really into my free self. Oh, I have this piece from The Hidden Lamp I want to read to you because I really like it. And I don't know if you know this. This is stories from 25 centuries of awakened women, and I really, I'm really enjoying it, and I would recommend it. So here's on Zazen. Zazen is the practice of intimately entering into the naked vulnerability of being human. Alone on our cushion, we become one with our particular life and the comings and goings of breath, thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Offering ourselves with wholehearted devotion, we connect with the spacious nature of who we really are. What arises is a deep trust that is rooted in this human body, enabling us to respond with freedom to what is before us. I love that deep trust rooted in the human body. I love that effect of Zazen. We all know that it's hard to describe to others what happens in the Zendo or even what a Dharma talk was about. Like 5 minutes later, you're like, what did I just experience? I don't know. How do I summarize that to somebody? But the changes that have occurred in me are not hard to describe. In some ways, they are harder to describe, but I've given you examples of like two really concrete, like easy things to describe. But what it feels like is that I have found my ground. So when the widening gyre is threatening to collapse, I have my center and I am rooted. So as a Sangha, we are losing some folks to death that have been constant presences in our Sangha life. And if you've been coming the last couple of Sundays, you've heard about two of those losses. Hojin Sensei has spoken about Yukon, or monastic, who lived at Zen Mountain Monastery and is now buried there. So as a monastic, of course, he was almost always at the monastery. And there's a depth to the constancy of a monastic life that I don't really know. For many of us arriving at ZMM, though, knowing that Yukon was there, especially in the beginning when it feels like a bit formidable, knowing that he was there was a real help to walk through the door, to know that you would feel welcomed and seen, right? We also lost Seyu Lanahan, who Yuna mentioned last week. And he was a longtime member of our temple, and he led the chants. Weekdays and before Kisei on Sundays. And his voice is still here with us. So as Buddhists, we practice this line, right, of presence and constancy. And it's at the edge of change and chaos, which means we're practicing our lives. We know and we seek to become very comfortable with constant change. This is what we have to do as Buddhists. This is what we, if we preach something, that would be what we preach, right? We know that it is the nature of all things to change and that impermanence is our most essential trait. We lost in this life our Yukon, our Seiyu, other losses. And sometimes that impermanence feels really, really awful. And other times it's a blessing, right? You're like, thank goodness this hard time is going to pass. Thank goodness this dark day, this mood, right? It's going to end. If you can sit through the storm of emotions, you know they're going to pass. And you can tell, I can tell myself that. I'm feeling it now, but it won't always be this way. And at the same time, I'm telling you that constancy is a value, right? So this is where things go from like the mundane to the holy. This is a quote. The nature of wind is constancy. There is no place it does not reach. So this is from a monk questioning a Zen master on why he was fanning himself. You know, why are you fanning yourself if it's the nature of wind to be everywhere? But in order to know and to touch and appreciate and become intimate with constant change, which is the nature of your life, right? You have to practice constantly. You have to keep fanning until you don't have to, no. I was going to say until you don't have to fan anymore, but I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. So I'm going to say you have to keep fanning until I know that you don't have to. I'm still at the fanning part. So if in a few years from now, if I know that I don't have to fan anymore, that I'll just feel the wind, then I'll tell you that part. But now it's not true for me. I have to put my butt on the cushion, right? Put your butt on the cushion over and over again. Get to know your chants by heart. Find refuge in liturgy, which only happens by touching your head to the ground or doing whatever bows you physically can do over and over again. And there's a sense of faith in this. It's a faith in the process and not worrying about the end result. What will I get from this? I don't know. It's different for everyone, right? But faith is constancy. Excuse me, the faith in constancy, faith in this consistent practice is a kind of free fall. Now constancy, which sounded so boring in the beginning, begins to feel interesting, right? It's a free fall, it's a leap. I don't know what it will bring, but I'm doing it. I'm sitting here, I'm bowing, head to the ground, head to the ground. There's a breaking open and your life becomes a sutra. Then the indeterminacy of life, the wonderful, awful impermanence of it, becomes easier to hold. So I said in the beginning that constancy is not just a portal to miracles, the miracle understanding of our own nature, but also an antidote to cynicism. And that's because constancy essentially says to the world, this is worthy of my care. Every day of every week, whatever I am called to, I will give it my presence, my attention. And when we do that, we're not being cynical. And it's so easy and tempting to be cynical right now in this world that we're living through. We give light when we give presence. We push back the cynicism. And there isn't anything that doesn't change when human presence is given to it. The person giving the attention changes, the person that receives it. I'm certain that you have noticed this in your life. When someone is giving you wholehearted attention, your first reaction is sort of like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then maybe the next reaction will be like, finally, someone's giving me all the attention that I so deserve and crave, right? You're like, someone's getting me. I can see it in their eyes. And then you start giving it to other people. Because presence is kind of contagious. So becoming present in your own life spills over to becoming present in the lives of others as well. Essentially, there are openings here where transcendence dwells. And transcendence is the opposite of cynicism. It's the opposite of habit. It's the opposite of despair. It leads to freedom. I'm almost done. But I want to say most, what I want to say most is that the Dharma does not just live in the temple, in this temple, as much as I love it. It's not kept behind closed doors. It's not opened by those who wear robes or those who have taken Jukai vows or Dharma holders or even teachers. It's your birthright, your jeweled possession, sewn into your clothes, And you can tap into it here, maybe in this space a little bit more than maybe in another space, but not necessarily. Maybe you can tap into it somewhere else just as well. You explore those things. You explore where the Dharma is alive for you. A friend can remind you of who you really are. The teacher does that as well for us. But it's your Dharma, it's your life, and your freedom that you're fighting for. As Nina Simone sings at the end of the movie Perfect Days, it's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC.